Hello, this is Josephine Gibson, and welcome to the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health in Conversation with podcast. We're well into Sepsis Awareness Month, and September 13th is World Sepsis Day. Sepsis disproportionately affects children. A staggering 50 million people are affected by sepsis globally each year, and about half of these are neonates and children younger than 19 years. And sepsis remains one of the leading causes of childhood morbidity and mortality, with immense direct and indirect societal costs. As if these weren't good enough reasons to have a conversation about pediatric sepsis in and of themselves, well then, 2024 has seen some important research developments in the field of pediatric sepsis that are worth highlighting. Also, live on our website is a brand new series about pediatric sepsis. Across four papers, this series shows the current state of diagnosis and treatment of sepsis in children. And it maps the challenges in alleviating the burden on children, their families, and society. I'm delighted that two key contributors to the series join me today to mark World Sepsis Day. Dialing in from the US, Nelson Sanchez Pinto is a pediatric intensivist at the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago. Nelson is also a biomedical data specialist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. He is considered one of the leading pediatric critical care informatics researchers. Thank you for joining, Nelson. And joining us from Switzerland, Lorenz Schlappbach is a pediatric intensivist currently working at the University Children's Hospital Zurich. Lorenz is a past pediatric study chair of the Australian and New Zealand Intensive Care Society. Many will know Loren for his efforts in advancing pediatric critical care trials. Loren, great that you could join us too. So, I just mentioned the pediatric sepsis series, which we published just last month. As a group of authors, you represent countries all over the world and bring an exceptional level of expertise and range of disciplines. How did you approach the research and writing about pediatric sepsis, and why did you feel it was important to approach the topic this way?
Thank you so much, Josephine, for this opportunity. I think we're immensely fortunate to have a group of amazing co-authors and colleagues from all over the world. And one of the key decisions at the outset, you know, together with the editors, was that the aim was that the four papers would really comprehensively lay out the current state, barriers, as well as future directions surrounding sepsis in children. So this is quite a different approach to, let's say, everything in one type of review approaches or specific papers on one very focused subpart. So we had to think through actually how can we really reflect on the landscape, how can we make sure we identify key barriers, and how can we have breadth in thinking about, you know, future solutions and leading to roadmap. In this context, I think it was a big advantage that we had worked with many of the authors through various groups before, you know, be that the Surviving Sepsis Campaign or some societal initiatives or the pediatric sepsis definition work. And so I think we knew each other pretty well, and I think we had come to appreciate the strength that every co-author brought to the party. And this was invaluable, in particular, you know, when it came to make sure that we have the perspective of some from not only from ICU, but as well from infectious diseases or ED, as well as from high and as well as lesser resource settings.
Yeah, I think the series has been very timely because we're in an inflection point for what is the research and care of pediatric sepsis. We have the new definitions that just came out, which are changing the paradigm, the new standard of how we think about sepsis. New technologies and communication and collaboration have allowed us to have this multidisciplinary global collaboratives. As Loren was mentioning, the Surviving Sepsis Campaign, as an example, the Phoenix Sepsis Criteria Task Force that made the new definitions, developed the new definitions, creating sort of this broader, more diverse group of collaborators, which I think are bringing a lot of innovative thinking and creativity in how we do research and how we define the next, you know, 10 years of pediatric sepsis care. And the third sort of confluence is the power of digitalization for providing care for patients, which is having an impact, you know, both in high resource and definitely in low resource settings. I think, you know, there's probably more smartphones than people in the world right now. Maybe that's an exaggeration, but we can harness that power both for communication, for collaboration, but also for decision support at the bedside to improve the care for sepsis. So I think this is where we're truly in an inflection point for pediatric sepsis. And I think this series sort of defines that landmark of what may come in the next decade.
Great. And we'll talk so much more about that later on in the podcast. Could we spend a couple of minutes just getting everyone on the same page about pediatric sepsis and what's so unique about sepsis in children as opposed to sepsis in adults? Lorraine, could you explain what's unique and how why children are so susceptible to sepsis?
So the concept of sepsis being a life-threatening organ dysfunction, which results from the way our immune system responds to an infection, you know, that concept is similar across age groups. However, actually, the epidemiology is vastly different. So out of 50 million estimated annual sepsis cases worldwide, about 50% of those, so about 25 million, occur in pediatric age groups, leading to an estimated about 3 million deaths. So children are disproportionately affected, and this is not just the case in lesser resourced settings. Even in countries such as the US, Canada, Australia, and Western Europe, sepsis in children, you know, remains amongst the leading causes of death, of preventable deaths, but as well of long-term sequelae and morbidity. So the lifetime risk of suffering from sepsis is actually highest during the first few years of life, and then it drops to during adolescence to a rate which remains relatively stable, and then during senescence, the risk starts going up again. And so what we see during these first few years of life, this unique susceptibility to sepsis actually comes from a number of factors. First of all, you know, the human immune system is gradually maturing throughout the first few years of life. This affects not only innate immune mechanisms, it affects various mechanisms of adaptive immunity. The impact of vaccination actually starts to build. And so we do know that children are much more susceptible to any type of invasive, in particular bacterial infection during the first few years of life. But as well, they're more susceptible to various types of viral infections, you know, respiratory syncytial virus, you know, being a very good example. So that is one part of it. But then there are other vulnerabilities as well. There is actually a socioeconomic vulnerability. Sepsis, to a degree, is a socioeconomic disease in the sense that although it may affect any type of patient, any type of person, then we do know that issues around education for sepsis, education to recognize sepsis, access to facilities and means actually, you know, to support care and recovery do influence actually sepsis incidence and sepsis outcomes. And the children out of all patients actually are the most vulnerable because they're disproportionately affected actually by by inequities in health. So this is the second vulnerability. Third vulnerability is that pediatric age groups have very different comorbidities compared to adult age groups. So we are much more a discipline of rare diseases, for example, you know, where congenital conditions play a major role. Many children, you know, which repetitively actually need to come back to a hospital. Then comorbidities such as malnutrition actually may affect, you know, children very differently as well. And so there's an interplay of these three factors. So the host immaturity, the vulnerability in terms of socioeconomic conditions, and as well, you know, the third point, which are unique pediatric comorbidities, which make the child extraordinarily susceptible to not only to sepsis, but as well to the sequelae after sepsis.
And these can be congenital diseases, for example?
Yeah, so in the Swiss pediatric sepsis study, which was essentially a prospective cohort assessing children with bacteremia, what we realized, and I think this is similar in many high-income countries, that largely there are three types of groups of patients that have sepsis. One group are preterm and term newborns. And they have classic patterns of, you know, perinatal infections and hospital acquired infection. And then you have a group of previously healthy children, which more commonly suffer from pathogens such as group A strep infections, pneumococci, staphylococci, and less so currently, you know, from meningococcal infections, for example. That's a very different pattern from all the children which have major comorbidities, where healthcare associated infections again, you know, prevail. And as you can see already, you know, within the few years of life that pediatric age groups cover, we can already see quite a number of very distinct, actually, phenotypes that characterize susceptibility, that characterize epidemiology, and as well, which characterize outcomes. And we're not even yet talking about more sophisticated approaches to phenotypes that Nelson actually is much, much better expert than I am.
Well, maybe that leads us to why there are such gaps in pediatric sepsis care. It's the complexity of just getting to grips with the mechanistic underlying phenomena of pediatric sepsis. But yes, Nelson, I'd love to hear more about the gaps and what you could say on that note.
Yeah, I think Lauren was very eloquent in terms of what we're missing. I think the other thing that we've been missing, the gap that we've been missing is sort of how we've defined sepsis up until now, which is changing with the new definition. There's been this historic discordance between what we define as sepsis for research purposes using criteria such as the systemic inflammatory response syndrome versus what people, what clinicians consider sepsis at the bedside, which is this sort of life-threatening organ dysfunction. Now that we have a more concordance in how we define sepsis for research purposes with what we consider sepsis at the bedside, I think we're going to see, find new patterns, new findings that may move the needle in pediatric sepsis care. I think that was the major gap that we had seen up until recently. And now the task is to move forward with this new paradigm of sepsis definition that may uncover new findings as we look at this condition with a little bit of a different perspective, a little bit of a different point of view.
So I gathered from reading the sepsis that a lot of the gap in the evidence base has to do with a lot of the data having come from high-income countries, which are not translatable to low and middle income countries. And it looks like with the development of the Phoenix sepsis criteria, you really took that into account.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Phoenix criteria, I think one of the strengths was the people that were involved in the design of the task force and the conception of the methodological approaches that we were going to take, and in parallel to that, the fact that we were able to engage with international collaborators to collect very granular electronic data from patients receiving care in low and middle income countries. This, for the first time, allowed us to work on a data-driven, data-informed consensus definition for a clinical syndrome, in this case sepsis, but it's, you know, unique to the fact that this is sort of the first experience, I think, where we have this combination of large database, machine learning methodology, diverse group of experts to define a clinical syndrome. And we did it in pediatrics, which I think is something that we should be very proud of. But we have for the first time the ability to do this thanks to the sort of this digital infrastructure in which we are now providing care for patients. And certainly the digital care is skewed to the high resource settings. Certainly we have established electronic health records or patient records in the sort of the higher resource countries. However, the digitalization is not stomping just in those places with high resources. We have seen a tremendous amount of digitalization across the world, and this is something that will continue to improve and expand. And so we have this opportunity to still leverage the same digital tools to better understand sepsis in low resource settings, high resource settings, to develop tools that work in low resource settings and high resource settings, and to translate the information that we get that we gain in one and other settings, sort of to help to improve the care across the world. As part of the task force, we have engaged in the development of digital tools, digital mobile tools for the calculating or estimating the criteria in children in low resource settings, and we have other sort of avenues of research in which we're trying to improve our understanding of sepsis in multiple contexts. For example, recently we've been working with a group in Bolivia to understand the effects of altitude in how we define respiratory dysfunction. As there's over 80 million people that live above 2,500 meters above sea level, and for those folks, saturation of 90% is a normal average, which 85% defining sort of hypoxemia. So that changes a little bit of how we think about respiratory dysfunction in those settings, and millions of children that live in those conditions, disproportionately low middle income countries in South America and Sub-Saharan Africa and the Himalayan region of Asia. So trying to keep everybody accounted for, and so more work that will come in that regard.
So Loren, I wonder, having heard about these advances, is there still follow-up work to be done?
So I think what Nelson just outlined is that there's been tremendous advances achieved by international collaboration to create a harmonized international data set, which was used for the Phoenix criteria. But I think we still have a lot of work ahead of us. So although evidence-based medicine is essentially the central dogma, of best practice, most areas of pediatric medicine, in particular of pediatric critical care, are actually not based on evidence because we have not generated that evidence. So I would say that we probably actually have not gone as far as we should have on the pathway from eminence-based towards evidence-based medicine. And as a pediatric discipline for a heterogeneous disease like sepsis, I think this is now a really urgent problem. So we do know first that most interventions and practices that we, for example, recommend in the surviving sepsis guidelines are not based on high-quality evidence because it does not exist. Second, we do know that there are very large numbers of children with sepsis cared for in lesser-resourced settings where it is really imperative that we have evidence for these settings too, where potentially very small strategies potentially could have a big effect size on mortality. And the third issue is that adult ICU currently actually is really getting ready or already embarking, on the journey towards precision medicine. And to be able to test and deploy and validate approaches towards precision medicine, actually you need even larger collaborations, more resources, larger patient numbers. So it is, as Nelson said, it is sort of an inflection point where we need to make more as a discipline and as a research community and clinician community that we really get ready for this.
Definitely. So you've touched already on barriers, but let's dive a bit more into what those are. So throughout the series and, as the campaign against sepsis has been saying for years, there are real barriers to reducing the burden of sepsis. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit more about your personal experience of those barriers, both in the clinic, but also in the research communities.
So maybe something very basic first, how I was trained personally, and I think many of us as doctors are trained, is learning means individual learning. So, if I see a patient where I probably, in hindsight, I could have realized earlier that the patient was getting worse and intervened earlier that the patient was getting worse, that is a bad outcome for the patient, and there is, incremental learning by people involved there. But the problem in sepsis is that although I may have learned this myself, maybe 2 weeks down the track, someone else in our team faces almost the same situation, not having gone through that learning process, and similar things happen again. And I think that's a key feature of sepsis, which has been called a disease of systematic failures to learn. That as healthcare professionals, we really have to, as much as we need to keep on that individual learning, we have to invest in systematic and institutional improvement. And this actually is something that I think as doctors, we have not really been trained well during our training, you know, because this involves actually a lot of aspects around assessing systematically, you know, how does your institution work? Is your ED structured in a way that they can recognize deteriorating patients? Are there communication systems in place that empower staff, you know, to speak up? Are there alert systems there which help to attract attention to certain patients, in particular during busy periods or nighttime periods when there's less staff? Are there systems in place to facilitate auditing and learning? You know, do you have meetings actually where these learnings are being emphasized? And is there societal uptake that actually, you know, this leads to some type of regular, you know, mandatory training? All of these are aspects which are extremely variable, sometimes even between institutions, certainly between countries, and where probably too many people try and, you know, reinvent the wheel. So one of the encouraging things around sepsis initiatives, I think, is that sepsis is a disease where often you see clinicians heavily engaged to try and improve because they have experienced this. You know, they have been there afterwards remembering that case and for weeks saying, actually, I could have done a better job. So this is something that actually, I think, motivates and drives a lot of us. But at the same time, there's not always sufficient efficiency in creating momentum from this. And I think an absolute exception there is the IPSO collaborative in the US, which, you know, is really building on over 10 years of quality improvement experience from different large children's hospitals now as well. I think more and more mixed hospitals and smaller hospitals, and which is really systematically building on the QI methodology to improve education, to improve changes at the bedside and measuring this. But many settings around the world actually are not resourced for or don't have actually the infrastructure or the systems in place to mount the response, such as IPSO. And this is where I see a key question, you know, how can we learn from each other as well at sort of institutional and systems level? Daniela's approach in Brazil certainly has to be very different from IPSO. But at the same time, you know, Brazil has achieved amazing improvements in some areas. You know, they may have one of the most impressive educational campaigns in some areas, for example. So they've really been able in the last few years to get sepsis on the map. So that's certainly something as well, you know, we can learn from.
And just to say, Daniela, you're referring to Daniela de Souza. She was also a lead author on one of these sepsis papers. So she's a pediatric intensivist at the University of Sao Paulo. But she's also current president of the Latin American Sepsis Institute. So she's widely known across all of Latin America for her efforts in improving sepsis, both for children and for adults. And it's a real shame she couldn't join us today, but absolutely right, highlighting where the settings that she works in and the resource challenges that she deals with and her real commitment to quality improvement. The failures to treat and the failures to follow up and to learn from these mistakes, they contrast really with how the pediatric oncology community really systematically builds in every child with cancer into a clinical trial, and that not a single opportunity is lost to learn from that. And this is something that you reflect on a lot throughout the series, this need to learn from a specialty like pediatric oncology for the reasons that you've just explained. So Nelson, I'm just really curious to ask, you've spoken so much about these digital tools, which sounds really exciting, but in low resource settings and across the world where we just have some very different kinds of barriers, I'd love to hear what you're thinking about in terms of reducing barriers to digitization of sepsis care?
Yeah, it's an incredibly important question. I think, as I mentioned earlier, there's an increase in sort of the digital infrastructure that's happening across the world, and it's not so much building the infrastructure that's the barrier; is leveraging that infrastructure for the worthwhile work that we need to do to improve the burden of sepsis. I think one key component as we're thinking about research or we're thinking about quality improvement is the idea of that you need to measure things if you want to improve them, right? If you can't improve a system if you don't measure it. And Loren a little bit ago talked about the IPSO collaborative. It's the Improving Pediatric Sepsis Outcomes Collaborative, which started in that very much in that vein. It's about measuring where we all stand, and a lot of places, including our own experience here in Chicago, was that we were doing very well in some aspects of sepsis care, but we were not doing so great in some other aspects. And it was this realization when we started measuring it in a systematic way that really focused our efforts on specific aspects. I think this idea of measuring is very translatable, very generalizable across the world. You just need the systems in place to be able to collect the right data and to systematically look at it. And there's certainly efforts around this concepts in multiple places. For example, in Latin America, there's the La Red network, which is a group of intensivists, pediatric intensivists from Latin America, with dozens of pediatric ICUs that collaborate in a shared registry where they measure they collect sort of measures of severity and patient outcomes in their ICUs around respiratory care, around sepsis, that I think are sort of the basis for a lot of this idea of measuring where we are and comparing ourselves with benchmarking ourselves with peers, as well as ourselves over time. Are we improving in our measures over time, which I think are two sort of foundational pieces of quality improvement. In Africa, there's the experience of the sort of the Wellcome Trust Kilifi registry in Kenya, which has done a tremendous amount of work in collecting detailed digitalized data on the patients that they provide care for. Again, sort of highlighting this idea that you can measure to improve care. And then based on that experience and other work, there's been the development of digital tools to improve the management of patients. For example, in Uganda, one of our colleagues, Matt Weens from BC Children's in Vancouver, collaborating with Ugandan researchers and providers, have developed a pediatric sepsis follow-up digital tool that has been associated with improved outcomes for those patients who have survived sepsis and historically have had very high mortality in the year after sepsis diagnosis, with sort of recurrence of sepsis and other comorbidities, where with a digitalized tool that helps improve the case management of these patients and return to care earlier, they have shown some signs of improvement in their outcomes. So this is in Uganda, obviously a sort of a sub-Saharan low income country where these tools are making a tremendous impact in the care of some of the most vulnerable children with sepsis in the world. So again, the idea is if you measure it, then you can focus your efforts. I think Matt's experience with post-discharge was this idea, this realization that when they measured outcomes, they had this tremendous amount of gap in realizing that most of these children were not dying in the hospital, they were dying after discharge, and sort of focusing on that aspect that helped that quality improvement initiative in having the impact that it has had. In other experiences within the high resource settings like the IPSO collaborative, again highlighting in which areas folks needed to focus. In our case, here in Chicago, we realized that we needed to focus on the hospital acquired sepsis in the inpatient setting. We're missing the boat there. We're doing great in the emergency department. We were not doing great in patients who were already admitted in the hospital. And likewise, I can think of other folks in other parts of the world will find different areas in which they need to focus. I'm sure Daniela and her team in Brazil, they may find other work that they need to work on in Sao Paulo or in Rio that may be different from others. And perhaps through these collaboratives, we can maybe, if we focus on the inpatient setting and they find that they have a problem in their inpatient setting, maybe we can collaborate and there may be some translatable information that we can use from here there. If we find that some of our post-discharge is not as optimal as we thought, maybe we can learn from the Ugandan experience and even translate some of those tools to here in the US or in Switzerland. I think we have to be creative about how we think about these collaborations and which areas we need to focus on.
Well, you certainly strike me as a very creative and very transdisciplinary group of scientists. So thank you so much. So that has really clarified the importance of quality improvement. But I guess the next challenge is, how do you make that scalable and sustainable? And Lorraine, I'd love to hear your perspective on this, because you've got experience from Switzerland, where you are currently, but you've also spent a lot of time working in Australia. And from these two settings, what would you say about how to get to build up quality improvement on a scalable and sustainable level?
What's striking is that despite different healthcare systems actually facing similar challenges, that the solutions, can be quite fundamentally different. And very often this is just based on, history and institutional constraints. But I think what we need to do more often, and in some ways the pandemic actually has shown some light on how this could be done, is to talk more across jurisdictions, across institutions, to gain insights from how are the others actually doing this. So to use an example, in Australia in 2017, led by Simon Finn from Georgia Institute, the National Sepsis Action Plan was formed. And it was an amazing, humbling experience actually to be part of that group. And Australia at that stage had very strong institutions, such as the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare, that had a say in the accreditation of hospitals, that had a strong focus, for example, on deteriorating patients, which already had implemented early warning tools and aspects as such. So in many ways, probably this was sort of fertile ground to tackle sepsis as one of the leading causes of why patients deteriorate, or why patients suffer suboptimal outcomes. But the core pillars of the Australian strategy, this was actually enhance public awareness and healthcare workforce education on sepsis, implement actually standards to recognize and treat sepsis and support, post-sepsis survivor families. These are actually quite applicable to other settings. And so in Switzerland, almost 5 years after the Australian National Action Plan, we used similar methodology to form a National Action Plan, which, despite actually being made by Swiss people for the Swiss healthcare system, actually had many similarities. And I think that's, as we now move towards the implementation of these aspects, we realize how much we can learn and adapt from each other. And in particular, I think when we want to extend our reach towards less resourced settings, or towards maybe very well resourced settings, but where the government is not providing support for targeted sepsis campaigns, we do need to increase efficiency by using materials that others have developed with some adaptation. And I think the community is very, very generous in this regard. But I think the spirit probably is new. And, to get back to the comparison with oncology, pediatric oncology 50 years ago realized we do need this type of global collaboration. They realized back then already that they need to build essentially an ecosystem which covers reliable capture of data through registries, which captures long-term mortality survival data of the patients, which allows industry actually to tap in, which allows to do trials, and which allows to do a lot of basic science studies on tumor tissue. And most of these things, actually, it was very obvious that they could not be done by groups in isolation. And I do believe that in the field of pediatric emergency care, critical care, sepsis care, it's been the last few years where I think the sense of the importance of global collaboration and really effective collaboration as well that we have the numbers, the efficiencies of scale, but as well the precision. I do think actually we're much newer to that, and so we do need to invest enough in that spirit of collaboration, in particular if we want to deliver, as I mentioned earlier, to really ramp up the degree of evidence that we have for our settings here, for less resource settings, and as well that we're ready to embark on precision medicine. The good thing is that we can, in many ways, now learn from oncology and adapt it. You know, a very good example are novel trial designs. So, you know, the shift, as evidenced during the pandemic, that we have to be a lot more agile, that we have to be able to start new interventions, add to trials, drop some if they're not performant. A lot of the methodology behind this actually stems from often pediatric oncology trials, which have developed this methodology, which in fact is very apt, you know, to be applied in the critical care setting. Or as well, more recent techniques such as, you know, multi-omics or single-cell sequencing, which in particular in the field of sepsis harbor immense potential, right? They often actually have been pushed a lot in the field of oncology. Now, oncology has the advantage they sample some tissue and then they have some time to look at it. The difficulty we face in our environment is that we often, it's not tissue, it's blood, but that's actually not bad. You know, we can do a lot with blood. But the time is such a critical factor, which is something that I think we still need to untangle better, right? Because the host response, you know, that we think is early is maybe already a host response that has been going on for 2 or 3 days, although the patient has just been hospital for 1 hour. And this may affect then as well, you know, target treatments, which in children, I suspect, some of which could be much more time sensitive potentially than in adults. And so again, this is a field where the skills of harnessing very large, high-resolution clinical data sets from electronic health records carries immense potential, because this is where we can truly longitudinally, you know, follow the trajectories of patients.
One thing we need to think about is the fact that a lot of the groundwork tends to happen, at the front line. And sometimes that gets forgotten in some of these sort of more global initiatives. That's, you know, we wrote an opinion piece with many of the sort of co-authors that we titled, Think Globally but Act Locally for Pediatric Sepsis. And I think that's the paradigm that we also need to move towards, which is both leveraging these national, international collaborations and initiatives and strategic plans, but also meet the sort of the frontline providers in the middle, right? So there's a contextualization and a localization of some of these initiatives that needs to be taken into account. How do we implement tools? How do we implement workflows in a way that is effective in the real world? I think sometimes we come with ideas, initiatives that are sort of, you know, plastered in front of the frontline providers who are just trying to get through their day, busy schedules, with heterogeneity of diseases that are managed. I think that one difference that we need to think about oncology is that patients, once they're diagnosed with cancer, they're treated by an oncology team, and they are they're the cancer docs. There's no such thing for sepsis. There's not the sepsis docs. Sepsis docs are, you know, the ED physicians, the hospitalists, the intensivists. And the nurses are the ones that that are treating also, you know, patients with some, you know, other acute care conditions that have nothing to do with sepsis. So the we have to understand that we're managing patients in a much more heterogeneous sort of setting, and we need to embrace that. And how do we meet sort of those local and contextual needs to implement tools and to implement initiatives in a way that are actually sustainable in the different contexts. So again, this think global but act local sort of approach.
Well, perhaps I can just come back to one of the questions that we sort of discussed in the lead up to this podcast, which was that very often these approaches that you've spoken about, Loren, about from Switzerland or Australia, they're not geared towards children necessarily. The two of you and the authors you've worked with and the your collaborators are already are all very mindful of your pediatric patients. But the reality is that numbers don't necessarily compare. The money is not necessarily flowing into the pediatric research. So how do you campaign for those resources to go into pediatric sepsis as opposed to sepsis generally?
To be honest, almost always when I approached adult colleagues for support, I received support and mentorship. In some ways we have to advocate for the unique needs of children and explain why these are truly unique. And that really involves a lot of advocacy and a bit of stubbornness. But at the same time, we should not isolate ourselves. You know, we should really check, actually work. Can we learn from adults? Where can we just use the same thing like adults and actually, you know, benefit from you know, the momentum that adults can bring to the party? And a good example are adolescents, for example. You know, adolescents, just by institutional practice, they usually can't be cared for mostly in pediatric facilities, but biologically, we actually don't know if they would be more adult-like than you know, childlike, for example. And yet, there's hardly any trial which has recruited adolescents into you know, adult-type studies. There's very few institutions which really jointly look after such patients. And I think this just shows that a lot of the separations we have between disciplines are just historic and institutional, but not necessarily justified by the facts, right? So at the same time, I think as well, adults have something to gain from working with pediatricians and with pediatric experts. I think the devastating impact of sepsis as a disease on a previously healthy child, you know, 5 years of life that dies, which would have had maybe 80 years ahead of life, you know, is can be very, very powerful. And so I think we need to think more of partnerships and not it's either adults or kids. Then I think it's there are always limited resources around no matter where you go. So, but our job as healthcare professionals, researchers, or as well, you know, policymakers is really how can we maximize the use of these resources? And often, actually, by better collaborations, better exchange, you can really gain efficiencies of scale. And one aspect that we have not really spoken about, and, you know, in some ways, maybe this is as well a shortcoming of this series, is the side of patient-family engagement. You know, when you involve patients and families in sepsis quality improvement work, in my experience, they're usually much, much more capable to make it clear what this is about than we are as doctors. And there is an immense power, which essentially is reminding everybody that this is not about your ego, your career, your institution. This is about, you know, we do this job for these patients, for these families. That's what this is about. And everything else needs to come after it. And I've seen in particular from families affected by sepsis in children, absolutely incredible waves of support and willingness, you know, to be very active. You know, the New York initiative for us to build off the death of Rory Staunton, and, you know, the whole initiative which the parents from Rory were able to mount in New York State, I think it has had worldwide implications. And I think this is a tremendous example of the power of engaging families. I must say, I don't know what you think, Nelson, but I must say this is actually something that in the series, if I were to do it again, I think I would discuss with the team from the outset where and how actually can we include some patient family members in the series too.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think the, you know, as I'm reflecting on this, and not to denigrate the work, the very important work in adult sepsis, but the classic adult patient with sepsis is somebody in their, you know, sixth or seventh decade of life, you know, with some you know, chronic comorbidity with maybe a urinary infection, who, you know, develops a bacteremia with a gram-negative bacteria and has a very high mortality from that. And it certainly is very important that we have awareness around this, that we have the ability to recognize signs of early sepsis in the elderly, particularly those with, senile memory problems. But on the other side of the spectrum, the other large group of patients who suffer from sepsis disproportionately are the patients that we take care of. Is that young child, oftentimes without comorbidities or with minor comorbidities that have sort of the ability, the opportunity to develop into productive members of society, so to speak, whose path is cut short because of a potentially devastating encounter with sepsis, with either high mortality, as we know that we see in many of our patients, up to 10% mortality in pediatric acute care is orders of magnitude higher than what we'd be expected from children mortality, probably much higher than the difference between sepsis and non-sepsis deaths in adult acute care settings. But not only that, but also those children who are affected by sepsis and have long-term sequela, and what we're losing is not necessarily years of life, but years of quality of life, where we have problems with learning, problems with daily functions of life, and the cost that implies to the families, to society too, and obviously the tremendous burden for the children themselves, as opposed to the ability to impact those trajectories for those patients with early recognition, with more targeted care that can sort of change the trajectory of those children into having better long-term outcomes and potentially decades of high quality of life.
Throughout this conversation, you've shown how complementary your experiences are in tackling this challenge. Your appreciation of other specialties such as pediatric oncology also signals a humbleness and a willingness to learn from colleagues in other specialties. You've laid down a roadmap, and although the challenges ahead are tremendous, I think it's safe to say that your transdisciplinary leadership will be a tremendous strength. On that note, I'm sad to say that it's time to bring our conversation to a close. Thank you again, Loren and Nelson, for sharing your time and thoughts on pediatric sepsis with me today. And I wish you all a productive World Sepsis Day. Goodbye for now.